Today on Maine Calling, Life After Cancer. It's the word no one wants to hear in a medical setting, but about one in three people will. Cancer. Today, the vast majority of people survive a cancer diagnosis for more than 5 years, and most for much longer. But it is still a life-altering experience. And the number of cancer survivors in the U.S. is expected to grow by 22 million people in the next decade. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, a conversation about what it's like to live your life after a cancer diagnosis and some of the resources in Maine to help. Are you going through cancer treatment? Are you a long-term survivor? What are your insights about how cancer changes your life? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville. And Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Every cancer patient is unique. That said, cancer survivors share some common challenges and experiences. Today we'll discuss how cancer affects people and what can make the journey a little easier. Joining me, Dr. Ekaterina Tsiopoli, who is a general surgeon and provider at Maine Health Breast Care and Cancer Support Care in Scarborough. Caitlin Shetterly, author of several books, including a new novel, Gulf of Lions. She is a breast cancer survivor. And Trevor Maxwell, a journalist living with colon cancer. He is the founder of the organization Man Up to Cancer, and this is focusing on men dealing with cancer. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you a cancer survivor? Is someone you love? Tell us about the biggest challenges, surprises, or ideas you have and things that you've learned about dealing with this more productively. You can send a quick email to talk@mainpublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Hi to all of you, Trevor and Caitlin. Welcome back to Maine Calling. Ekaterina, welcome to Maine Calling. And Ekaterina, I'll start with you. Our understanding of, or the way we talk about cancer survivors is changing, isn't it? As soon as someone is diagnosed, they're considered a cancer survivor. Why? Why do we talk about people this way now?
Well, we talk about it that way because we have to plan early to get people to be to transition to a successful survivorship. Technically, and every cancer is a little bit different, patients who are still in active treatment are not considered survivors. But once you're finished with active treatment and you go into a maintenance phase, that's when technically survivorship starts. But again, we're thinking about it very early. We're planning ahead.
And I read that by 2035, we're going to have 22 million more cancer survivors in the U.S. I'm guessing, Dr. Tsiopoli, the reason we're going to have more cancer survivors is that treatment is improving.
Exactly. I'm going to say from my my little corner of the world that we have over 4 million breast cancer survivors right now in the U.S., which is a huge accomplishment. So that is, earlier diagnosis contributes to that, better treatments contribute to that. So we're thankful for that.
Right. Trevor, last time you were on Maine Calling was 2022. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing really well. And it's thanks to science, right? You just touched on it. I've been living with colon cancer, metastatic colon cancer for 8 years, and it's because of advances in the science. Specifically, Immunotherapy. So immunotherapy, the two scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2018 for PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibition. Well, those are the drugs that are saving my life. So these are very recent drugs that are available, right, as standard of care. So it allows a person like me to see my daughters grow from 12 and 10 to 21 and 19. So it's pretty amazing. I'm so thankful for the investment in public and private research.
You founded Man Up to Cancer because you found that a lot of men don't like to turn to others when they go through a crisis, and that actually it's very good for you to turn to others. Tell me about the growth of your organization. It's kind of exploded, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that just speaks to the need, that unmet need for psychosocial support for men. So I came up with the concept at the end of 2019, right into 2020. Then we had a pandemic that doubled up on isolation and loneliness for men going through cancer. 6 years later, we have over 40 chapters across the US and Canada and a couple overseas. We're doing retreats year round. We have a backpack program. And I think the lane that we occupy in survivorship is issues around isolation and loneliness. There's a lot of science coming out every year that shows us that isolation and particularly loneliness really impact quality of life, substance abuse, broken relationships, suicide, and also worse medical outcomes. So my message out there is, hey, if you're one of these people that's isolating and going through this alone, it's getting out of that isolation could actually save your life.
And I want to circle back because you were talking about immunotherapy saving your life, Trevor. Your cancer diagnosis was very serious at first, correct? I mean, stage four, right?
Yeah, still has been. So 7 major abdominal surgeries, lots of chemotherapy and immunotherapy. So immunotherapy hasn't cured me. I'm still on treatment every 2 weeks at New England Cancer. Shout out to the folks over at Rock Row. But it has enabled me to manage my disease as a chronic illness. And that's there's more and more of us, right, who are living longer with cancer, not necessarily after we're cured or no evidence of disease.
Caitlin Shetterly, you're an author. Congratulations. I understand your new novel comes out tomorrow.
It does. It's very exciting.
And you have a really not the twist that you would like to have in your life, where your own life has mimicked your lead characters, correct? Your protagonist.
Yes. I wrote a book. I want to say first, Katarina, thank you. You just explained a couple things to me about survivorship. And Trevor, it was wonderful to hear you speak. And I'm so glad you're still here with us and
Thank
you're
you.
Doing as well as you're doing. I wanted to write a novel about a woman who survives. I wanted to write a novel about that was a survivor's story. I had spent years and years reading to my two boys all these books of where the mother is dead or both parents are dead, but often the mom is dead as a doornail, or she's dying. And then the children get into, interesting sort of have interesting adventures. And I was wondering about that long before I was ever diagnosed with cancer, and I was thinking about how many women actually survive rather than die, especially now. And so I finished my book in October of 2024. I had given my character Alice a hormonal breast cancer in her left breast. She had stage 2B. And then 6 months later, I was diagnosed with the exact same cancer in the exact same breast. And to say that was a shock probably underestimates exactly how it felt for me. But what was interesting about it was that in some ways I had already gone through the emotional experience of my character. And so I had thought through a lot of this. Now, Katarina can tell you, because I know her from Maine Health, that once I got into my own journey of cancer, I didn't look anything up. I wanted only the doctors to tell me. I trusted them. I wanted the science presented to me, and I wanted to do what they said. But I had spent a year meticulously researching Alice's cancer. She had a mastectomy. I was lucky enough to keep my breast. In fact, when it came down to deciding whether or not I was going to have a lumpectomy or a mastectomy, I actually didn't have the courage she had to lose my breast. I was very traumatized by that idea. But one of the things, Trevor, you were talking about that I found very moving is about loneliness and isolation. There's a wonderful organization in Maine called Community Plate that brings people together for suppers, community suppers, and it's about fighting loneliness and isolation. And a lot of women have said to me too, not just men, it's the loneliness and the isolation. And long before I had cancer myself, I wrote about Alice. And how lonely it was. And at one point in the book, she talks about watching the light in her bedroom and how she would miss light. But it's a funny thing, right? If you're dead, you're not going to miss anything. But when you're presented with your own mortality, you think about what you would miss, or maybe what other people would miss you missing. It's an interesting thought process to have. And I really went very deeply into that in my novel. And I wanted to have a woman who's gone through this fear. She's got two daughters, and she goes off to France with her two daughters, and she reclaims her sensuality. She starts to taste food. She feels the salty Mediterranean on her skin. She lives with a little bit of reckless abandon for a few weeks, and that was really important to me to show a woman not just surviving and going through the drudgery of surviving and the loneliness and the isolation, but thriving.
And Caitlin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I mean, I got amazing care through Maine Health. I really did. I had the best care team in the world. And my oncologist is at New England Cancer Center. So I have a sort of a hybrid of both of these amazing organizations. My radiation was done at Maine Health in Portland. I had those guys, shout out to them. They're in the basement of that hospital and they are down there saving lives every single day. And there was this young man named Mo, and I cried every day after radiation. Radiation's very painful, or it was for me. And I cried every day when I was getting off that table. It was just the shock of it, the machines, the isolation, the loneliness of that room with them all beeping around you. Holding your breath and knowing that if you make a mistake, maybe the radiation's going to hit your lung. It was a lot to hold. And but there was this young man named Mo, and he hugged me every day when I got off that table. It saved me. And I also had amazing friends who drove me to radiation every day. And that was also incredible because I was never alone.
Dr. Siopoli, go ahead.
I don't know, this is great information for everyone who's listening, but Caitlin and Trevor raised a point that is very close to my heart. First of all, how do you deal with this? How do you live long, which science has allowed us to do? How do you live for many years with this diagnosis? How do you put it in a box so it doesn't take over your entire life? That takes a lot of guts and a lot of introspection and a lot of courage. So, respect. As a surgeon, I always think, how can I make this easier for my patients? How can I make the price in quotations they have to pay, the sacrifices they have to make, a little bit less, a little bit smaller? So a few years down the road, they look down at their chest, because that's what I do. I'm a breast surgeon, and they remember me fondly. So there's a lot of work and a lot of thought that goes into the planning of a surgery, if you would, and how we make it more cosmetically appearing, less scarring, less painful for patients who live many, many years after this experience. So a lot goes into that. A lot of thought goes into that.
I want to, Dr. Siopoli, Katerina, I want to follow up on something Trevor said about what the evidence shows about getting things that seem kind of amorphous, like going to support groups, maybe doing yoga, seeking out other survivors. Is there data to show that yes, people survive longer when they do these things?
Definitely. And I think more is coming because we are westernized medicine is kind of we're taught to dismiss things like that. But I'm a little special. I grew up in Greece. So I'm always going back to my roots and thinking, what did my mom say? How can we use food as medicine? How can we use our centering as medicine? So I always advocate to my patients to doing those things because it takes a lot of work that only you can do as the patient. So being more centered, finding whatever works for you, whatever your support system is. There's no one size fits all. We give some recommendations, but every person has to think about it and find the what works best for them. And it's important to take a moment to quiet things down and listen to yourself, listen to your body, and give it time to heal and recruit other things, people, whatever works for you to help you do that.
Trevor.
Yeah, I'll just tack on that. There's plenty of studies. I've been kind of collecting studies on isolation and loneliness over the years. There was a meta study done last year. I think it was in the British Journal of Oncology. I can't remember the name of it, but I'll just read the quickly the stat is people with cancer who feel lonely or isolated have about a 34% higher risk of dying from any cause and 11% higher risk of dying from cancer specifically, compared to those who feel connected. So this is not rocket science, right? This is the human desire for authentic connection. And we're already facing an epidemic of that loss in our digital age when we're all on our screens and we're not authentically connected. I love that Caitlin brought up community plate. So things like that, you're seeing a revival in that, but you have this baseline isolation and then you put this critical illness on it and then you start seeing those type of statistics.
Trevor, are those statistics helpful for the spouse, the sibling, the child who is trying to drag their loved one to a support group, to a place like the Dempsey Center and finding resistance?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, so I've worked with hundreds, thousands of men over the past 6 to 8 years, and we find that on a population level, there's certain patterns of male behavior. Individual results may vary, right? Not every man struggles with isolation and loneliness, and certainly plenty of women do as well. But what we see at the population level is that isolation. So oftentimes, it's men can be practical. They want to know, well, why am I doing this? Is this just kumbaya and I'm going to be coming out and getting into this group and, holding hands? And it's like, no, you can do lots of different things. There's lots of different ways to access community. But yes, that's one of the things. So one of our biggest referrers to Man Up to Cancer is the spouse, the partner who sees their guy struggling and says, going into the man cave, retreating. I was there. I struggled with clinical anxiety and depression for most of my first year of cancer, and I wasn't the same person I am now. And I got help at the Dempsey Center, especially. Shout out to my counselor, Patty, who helped save my life. So yes, I think it's those people who are around those guys in isolation that see them. They're not engaging in those activities. They really are struggling, and we need to pull them out from that. Whether it's Man Up to Cancer, other communities, going solo is not the is just the thing that we say that can't be the option.
Caitlin.
Well, first of all, it's so good to hear you, Trevor. I'm having a hard time keep having a dry eyes here, but I was just gonna say, picking up from what Katarina was saying, yoga and all these things that one can do. The other thing is you can't probably do it all. So when I was researching my character Alice, she does, a macrobiotic diet. She ends up realizing that her husband is sort of distracting to her when she goes for her treatments. So she does them alone because she feels like a lot of women do, at this stage in life, in middle age, they're carrying their children, they're, aging parents, and she sort of feels like she has to worry about her husband. So she tells him not to come anymore. But she tries all these different things and she's doing yoga and everything. I found that when I was actually diagnosed, I realized pretty quickly I could not do all those things. So I just had to eat food, the best food I could, but I did not go macrobiotic or do any of those things. And I remembered that I had given Alice yoga. And so I started going to Uprise Hot Yoga in Freeport, and I found a real community there. I told my teachers what I was going through, and they told all the other teachers, and just sort of like by osmosis, everybody was so tender with me and supportive. And that's been a wonderful place for me to go. I try to exercise. So I do think that there's this feeling as a cancer patient, like, I'm gonna have to do it all. I'm gonna have to change everything. And Many of us are, we've got families, we've got kids, we've got lives, we've got jobs, and we've got the shock and the work of cancer. My God, cancer is so much work. I didn't actually work for 8 months. Like, I made no money for 8 months. It can drive most of us really into a hard financial place, and already things are expensive in this country. So I just want to say to anyone going through it, you don't have to do it all, or I don't think you do. Katarina's the doctor here, and just some of it, the best you can.
Well, we do have to take a break. We are talking about cancer survivorship on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It is not easy living with cancer, even years out from surgery or treatment. Today, we're hearing from cancer survivors about challenges and about tactics for living a joyful life. Joining me for the hour, Caitlin Shetterly, an author whose new novel, Gulf of Lions, features a woman who has breast cancer, and Caitlin herself was diagnosed with breast cancer after she wrote the book. Trevor Maxwell has been living with colon cancer since 2018. He's a journalist and the founder of manuptocancer.org. And Dr. Kat Ciopoli is a surgeon with Maine Health's Breast Care and Cancer Supportive Care in Scarborough. On the line with us now, Brandon Johnson. He is a lymphoma survivor. Thanks so much for calling in, Brandon.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I understand you have a very long journey, and we don't have time for all the details, but tell us about it. It started in 2019 when you felt a pain in your leg.
Yes, and then I promptly ignored it. And then it took lots of support from my wife, Christina, who's like, you need to get this taken care of because your right leg is twice the size of your left leg.
Whoa.
So I credit my life to my wife.
And
And it's a I'm
what kind of a treatment did you go through?
So I had R-CHOP, which was a pretty extreme type of chemotherapy. I only had to do it 6 times, once every 3 weeks. But it was pretty rough.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I understand you and your wife wanted to have a child, and that was a big consideration when you were going through your treatments. How did you think about that, and what did you do in the end?
Yeah, so we had only been married for, I think, 6 months by the time I got diagnosed, and we were like, we're pretty young. We were in our late 20s, and we decided to go through Boston IVF ahead of chemotherapy because they can, through chemotherapy, you can become sterilized, and so. We went there and we did the storage, and then actually just last year, around this time actually, we went through the IVF process 7 years later, and we welcomed our daughter Nora in December, and she's about to turn 5 months old, I think, later this week.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. And how are you doing?
Congratulations.
Yeah, how are you doing,
Thank you very
Brandon?
much. I'm sorry?
How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I've been cancer-free for about, I think, 7 years now. I think it'll be, 7 years since my diagnosis anyway, I believe, which was in June, the official diagnosis of 2019. There was some rough spots immediately after getting the all clear because I was incredibly positive and all that throughout the treatment. But then once I kind of got the quote unquote all clear, my last session of chemotherapy, I crashed, just being positive all the time. And then it took my wife again, be like, hey, you are acting not yourself anymore. Are you okay? And then I went to my PCP, and he's like, yeah, you definitely should be getting some help with this. And so I went on some medication for a while to get my serotonin and dopamine back up to normal levels. But a year or so after that, I was back to my good old self without the need of the medication and just the support and love of family and friends. I'm back up to 100%.
Oh, wonderful. Caitlin, I think, has a question for you. Caitlin, go ahead.
Well, it was really just a comment. Trevor, thanks for sharing that. I mean, sorry,
Brandon.
Ian?
Brandon. Yeah.
Excuse me. Thank you for sharing that. I think that falling apart is so normal. Katarina could probably speak more to this, but I had a similar kind of period of just letdown in August of last year when I finished my radiation. And then in January of this year, I became very down. And I think it's the shock of it and this realization that you are always for the rest of your life going to be looking over your shoulder, which initially was the thing that, that's what initially drew me to writing a character in a novel, was this Orpheus quality, this sort of the uncertainty. But now that I've lived it, it is so real for me. I would say one thing that for me, and maybe you'll experience this too, Brandon, that's kept me going is my children. Because you just, one of the things about children is you have to say okay and keep going. There's so much else to live for and to keep going for. You know, that's all.
Dr. Siopoli.
Yeah.
Yes. So first of all, Brandon, congrats on accomplishing so many things and having a baby amidst all this. That's wonderful to hear. And I call this the post-treatment blues, and I so happens very, very often. And I've made it my practice to warn my patients about that kind of earlier on, as soon as they're getting close to the end of treatment. It's you're going from survival mode, go, go, go. Let's get treatment. Let's do everything that we can. Let's stay positive about it. All of a sudden, a little bit of a withdrawal. You know, everything, you don't have as many appointments anymore. You don't have the treatments going on. And you're like, what just happened to me? So
yeah,
it is
also,
very,
if I could just add in, and everyone around you is celebrating. So for the guys in our group, they get finished with treatment. All of a sudden, right, they don't have that mission and they have time to process. And they're like, what the hell did I just go through? And they are struggling. But everyone else is like, you're done. You made it. You should be happy. And there's pressure on these survivors to stay right with that smile all the time when they're just starting to grapple with what they've been through.
And I think support also, which is natural, of course, kind of ebbs a little bit. That is something that needs to be communicated. People need to be aware of that this is not the end. So you need to double down on support. You need to double down on your efforts to get back to normal. And it is not going to happen overnight.
Brandon, before we let you go, I want to ask you what advice you have for any others who might go through lymphoma or just anything, any cancer diagnosis and rough treatment like you had.
Well, like it's been stated before, make sure you have some sort of support system, whether it's Man Up to Cancer or the Dempsey Center. I utilize the massages that they offer to cancer patients, and they also offer services to the spouses as well, because they're going through a lot as well, being your caregivers in a way. Find that support system and try and be as positive as you can. And even when you're all set, continue seeking that support, because like what happened to me, I had that crash that I wasn't necessarily warned about. And just try to do your best.
Brandon, thank you so much for calling, and go give Nora a hug for us. Boy, 5 months, you're about to enter a really fun stretch of babyhood. Brandon Johnson
is so amazing.
Yeah, they're so, The 6 months to a year is just magic. Brandon Johnson, a lymphoma survivor who lives in Saco. Now we're going to turn to Shauna Ackley. She's a breast cancer survivor who has been a vocal advocate for affordable health care. Thanks so much for calling in, Shauna.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on here. And I've really enjoyed hearing the conversation so far and how important community is. And I just wanted to highlight something also out of that is sharing your story, right? When you share your story, you don't know how many people that you're impacting. And for myself, there was a beautiful soul named Eliza, and she shared her breast cancer story. And when I found a lump in the summer of 21, I ended up getting that checked. I was 38. I was a busy mom chasing a toddler around, and I had no risk factors. And it cost over $1,000 for a diagnostic mammogram and an ultrasound when I found that lump. And because of Eliza's story, I didn't disregard myself. And she gave me a chance at early detection. And out of that, I just have really thought of all the women and men that think that this isn't something and don't go through with early testing because of the cost. And that, you know, just it brought me on this journey where now I've been to Washington, D.C. 5 times. I've testified at the State House to advocate for affordable health care, whether that is through the Access to Breast Cancer Diagnosis Act to eliminate the cost of breast imaging, or speaking up about the Affordable Care Act subsidies that were expiring, and also for cancer research to be able to have the right treatment at the right time. So it's been just really eye-opening.
Shauna, thank you for sharing that and for your advocacy work. I need to ask you, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, and I am so grateful to have the community that I have. Before I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I was a Try for a Cure participant, and so I had a beautiful community of friends that were survivors, and I knew that I would be okay. And then from there, I have met other friends that are survivors. I actually just got back from a beautiful retreat that was this weekend with a local breast cancer group called Tatas and Tapas. And that community, you can be with each other and not say anything and fully understand how that person's feeling. And there's just something really special about that.
Well, thank you so much for taking part of the program today, Shauna Ackley, a breast cancer survivor and advocate. We have so many calls and emails coming in. I'll go to this email from Muffy. After doing all the right things after my first diagnosis, my breast cancer took a metastatic path. I'm on a clinical trial with positive results and side effects that are a handful. What I know, doctors prescribe treatment and we step up to make ourselves healthy. 3 key things I follow and share. Hydrate. Electrolyte tablets are helpful. Bone broth is an all-star. 2, eat something. No appetite, that's your clue to fuel, to fight, and recover. Eat protein. It's not about what tastes good. It's about fuel. Taste comes back in time. And 3, move. Even a little effort triggers a much-needed circulation. No matter what, think and stay positive. It makes a difference. And it goes without saying that the Dempsey Center is a rock star. Their acupuncture aided me through chemo. Dr. Ciopoli, Kat, what do you think of her advice?
That's wonderful. Solid advice. Very, very solid. I agree with everything she said. I think keep an open mind. Try things that may, acupuncture, Reiki, may have sound a little foreign, or you may not have had an opportunity to take advantage of before. Keep an open mind and see what works for you. Taking care of yourself is key. And movement and good nutrition are exceptionally useful. And I will also say that mentally, from our mental health standpoint, cancer should give you the license to let go of things that don't serve you, even for a short amount of time. And my patients are women, so and we all know that women carry the mental load for so many people. And I'll never forget a patient of mine who was going through chemotherapy, and her adult daughter still relied on her to help her move or something like that. And I told her, no, just say no. Just find the strength to say no. She's an adult. She can do it. And it's just we have to adapt. We have to take care of ourselves. And that is not selfish.
Trevor.
Yeah, let me jump in on that because I love this part. This conversation is great. A lot of cancer patients feel the pressure to, like in pop culture, you see these cancer patients who are running Ironman races and they're doing huge fundraisers and they're working full time. And for most of us, that's just not realistic. So Lona is a great friend and other survivor at the Dempsey Center. Way back in when I was first going to group years ago, she said, instead of your best day ever, we want to talk about our best day possible. So Man Up to Cancer uses the hashtag BDP. And that means maybe your best day possible is having a couple eggs and maybe taking a walk to the mailbox or writing one letter. But it's not about, right? Not everything has to be this crazy thing. And I think Caitlin said it earlier. It's like, sometimes you get diagnosed and you think you're going to do it all and you're going to do all this nutrition and exercise and this and that. And you know what? Sometimes it's doing what you can.
We'll go to Tyler calling from Wells. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, I am just on my way back from Dana-Farber. I'm in a clinical trial for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I just passed my 8-year scan.
Wow.
So I thought I would share my story. I had a cancer that came back at me 3 times. No modern treatments work for me. I went through the same treatment that gentleman was just talking about, the R-CHOP, leading into a stem cell transplant, and then I relapsed once again. And at that point, I was offered a chance at a clinical trial for this new process called CAR T-cell therapy, where they essentially genetically modified my T cells and then reinfused them into me, and that my own T cells then recognized and eradicated the cancer.
Oh, Tyler, I'm so happy for you. Dr. Ciopoli, is there anything you'd like to say about the CAR T cell therapy?
I am the wrong person to ask about that, but I will give kudos to my organization, Maine Health, because we are starting a program like that. So patients will not have to travel to Boston anymore. And my personal mission is to have my patients, breast cancer patients, travel to Boston as little as possible, which is why I started offering a lot more surgeries that they have to go there to do. So there's hope down the road for good care closer to home.
Caitlin.
Yeah, I mean, my husband, we did go down to Dana-Farber as well. And Dan, my husband, was interested in seeing sort of what their take on my cancer was. And I had stage 1A cancer. I just want to also make that clear. And we ended up staying in Maine and staying close to home. And I got to tell you, boy, did that feel good. And I really truly believe you can get such excellent care in Maine now, and you don't have to go all the way down to Dana-Farber. And I was so grateful for it. One thing I'd love to talk about and hear from Trevor also is just, or no, is maybe about the shame with cancer at some point if we have
time.
Yeah,
we do need to go to a break, but we can talk about that in a little bit. Tyler, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. We do need to take a break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, we are examining what it means to be a cancer survivor. Joining me for the hour, Trevor Maxwell, colon cancer survivor, and the founder of the organization Man Up to Cancer. Dr. Kat Ciopoli, who is a surgeon with Maine Health, and Caitlin Shetterly, an author and breast cancer survivor. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We're joined now by Brandon Hotham, who is president and CEO of the Dempsey Center. Brandon, thanks for calling in. And I just have to tell you, so many people are sending emails or mentioning the Dempsey Center. I'm going to read one right here. PJ writes, as a breast cancer survivor, I cannot say enough about the support given by the Dempsey Centers in Lewiston and Westbrook. They are places of serenity, calm, peace, operated by the kindest people on earth. I found them a grounding and centering place when I felt adrift. Also, a shout out to MO and Maine Health Radiation Center. That is an awesome crew. So, Brandon, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for hosting this topic. I think it's important, and I've been able to listen into some of the conversations this morning, and it's been great. And so we're definitely appreciative that folks know about the center and know that we're available to folks navigating cancer and navigating cancer survivorship.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have Patrick on Maine Calling a few years ago to talk about the reason he founded the center. But for those of us who weren't lucky enough to hear that show, remind us, how did the Dempsey Center get started?
Yeah, great question. So the Dempsey Center started in 2008. We, for the first 10 years of our history, were a division of Central Maine Medical Center. We were a charitable division of the hospital. And since 2018, we've been our own independent 501c3 nonprofit. And Patrick, along with his sisters, Mary and Alicia, started the center because their mother, Amanda, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 1997. She experienced about a dozen recurrences before her passing in 2014 as a result of that cancer. And what they found was that she had incredible access to good quality oncological care in Maine and northern New England, but everything that cancer impacted in her life and in their family's life, really they felt like there wasn't resources or support available to them outside of her treatment. And they really felt like, you know, their quality of life as a family should be considered. And so that was the genesis for starting the center, was a way for Patrick and his sisters and their family to give back to the state of Maine and beyond.
Brandon, how much does it cost to use the Dempsey Center?
All of our services are available at no cost, so we are entirely philanthropically funded. We, like lots of nonprofit organizations in Maine, are really built on the community that supports us. So $5, $10, $15, $20, $50 donations are really what sustain us. We served just under 2,900 unique individuals last year and provided over 26,000 visits across all of our supportive care programs. We have our annual Dempsey Challenge, which is our biggest community event and fundraiser, coming up on September 19th. And our goal is to raise $1.9 million through that event. That's about 40% of our annual operating budget. So philanthropy, community support is really, really important. And we don't bill or charge for our services because we know that by the time people find us, cancer for the vast majority of people is a pretty financially toxic situation. And we don't want people's ability or inability to be able to pay for supportive care to be a barrier for people to access that care, because we know it helps with treatment outcomes. We know it helps with quality of life. And so we don't want cost to be a barrier for anyone impacted.
And one of our listeners already mentioned, acupuncture. What are some of the other services?
Yeah, so we provide services across a whole host of programs. The easiest way to describe it is to break it down into three categories. So we have our counseling program, which is one-on-one counseling and support group-based counseling, all delivered via licensed clinical social workers who are oncology social work certified. Then we have a whole host of integrative complementary therapies, things like acupuncture, oncology-focused massage therapy, Reiki, nutrition programs, and movement and fitness programs. And then a whole host of comfort and well-being programs. That includes Clayton's House, which is our hospitality home in Portland, Maine. So anyone traveling 30 miles or more for cancer-related treatment or services can stay at that house at no cost. We have a pet therapy program called Dempsey Dogs. So we have pet partners certified therapy dogs at both of our centers to provide comfort to folks as they're accessing our services. We do wig and headwear support, so anyone facing cancer-related hair loss can come in and get a free wig or headwear piece, and we'll teach folks how to style that and how to care for that. We have a resource library, And then all of our educational programs fall into that category too. So we do programs on dealing with your finances during healthcare. We have a program called Transitioning into Survivorship, as an example. That's a 6-week program
Wow.
run by our psych-soc team to talk about, you know, common things that cancer survivors have to navigate post the finishing of their traditional treatment schedule.
Wow. Wow. Brandon, thank you so much for calling in. And I'm certainly sure that many people listening right now had no idea. Brandon Hotham is with the Dempsey Center based in Lewiston and Westbrook. We'll go to Stephen, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you today?
Wonderful. And you?
I just got back from the hospital.
Oh.
Anyways, I was diagnosed with fourth stage lymphoma back in 1988 and ended up going through surgery where half of my stomach was taken out, my jejunum, and then I started chemotherapy. And on my first session of chemotherapy, my wife went with me and I went in, but as we went in, there were three women who were sitting in a corner talking and enthusiastic. And so while I was doing my chemo, my wife and I spoke with the three women. And the three women were members of HOPE groups, which stands for Healing of Persons Exceptional. And the HOPE groups were created out of the surgical practice of Ken Hamilton, who was a surgeon and a surgery at the hospital in Norway years ago. And he started HOPE, that stands for Healing of Persons Exceptional, and we ended up going to that HOPE group. And part of that HOPE group is that he also did guided imagery. And so he worked as a HOPE group guide, not a counselor. He was guiding people through their experience in a HOPE group. And a lot of it had to do with attitudinal healing.
And Stephen, it sounds like that made a huge difference for you.
Oh, absolutely. The guided imageries that he did opened up the right-hand side of my brain, and I started writing songs on piano and songs on on my guitar.
Thank you so much, yeah, for calling and sharing that, Stephen. And just, I did some math when you said that you were diagnosed in 1988. You are a 38-year survivor, so so happy to hear that. And thank you for calling in today. We are so tight on time, but Caitlin Shetterly, you brought up a very important point, the shame that goes with cancer. And it makes me so sad to hear that, because I thought this whole stigma was something from a couple generations ago.
I mean, I think that it was really great hearing Brandon from the Dempsey Center. You know, there's the financial part that creates shame, the shame that your body failed, that it did this, that you must have done something to make this happen. You must have had a lifestyle thing. And you know, I mean, there are people with lung cancer who have never touched a cigarette, right? Can you imagine what they feel? It's just the shame and explaining it to people, trying to break that sort of funny wall and say, well, I'm actually recovered from cancer. It is hard. I don't, Trevor and Katarina, maybe you have more thoughts about this, but it is something I have felt in myself and I thought about when I was writing my character, Alice.
Oh, shame, boy. Wow. Caitlin, thanks for bringing that up, because man, again, my first year after diagnosis, I was 41. Middle of my life, raising young daughters. I felt like I was the one that always should be there for them. And all of a sudden I'm facing this life-threatening illness. I was facing all these losses, like loss of sense of control and loss of confidence, loss of mastery in my environment, identity, all these things. And also physically, I'm 6'4", 240. Like I do all the stuff around the house. I split the logs and heat our house and all these things. Even having guys come over to stack the wood or mow the lawn, it was very emasculating in a way. And I'm a co-provider and co-leader of my family with my wife, but all of a sudden I couldn't be that. And so I went into a deep place of shame. And again, seeing like in pop culture, feeling like everyone's just crushing cancer. And here I am depressed, anxious, almost in inpatient hospital for my mental health. And I felt like a failure. And I felt like a burden on my family. Mm-hmm. And so there was a deep period of shame. And it comes full circle to what we're talking about today, where if I didn't have an amazingly loving wife, because I just wanted to go up to Northern Maine and disappear. That's where I was. And my wife's like, you need help. And that's when I went over to the Dempsey Center and started getting it. But if I was alone, I might have just disappeared, right? And there would be no man up to cancer. There would be, I wouldn't be probably be here today. So it's getting the help. And for a lot of people, reaching that point where accepting help, reaching out and getting it, because Maine has it. Maine has so much help, so many resources. So thanks for bringing that up.
And Trevor, we have a couple calls that we can't get to, and these are people who are looking for connection. Would you recommend that they start with the Dempsey Center if they're female, and maybe man up to cancer if they're a man?
Yes, absolutely. Go dempseycenter.org, manuptocancer.org. We get in touch with us. The contacts are right there, and we'll put you in the right direction.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for this great conversation today. The voice you just heard, Trevor Maxwell, a journalist living with colon cancer, and he is the founder of the nonprofit Man Up to Cancer. Dr. Ekaterina Tsiopoli is a general surgeon at Maine Health's Breast Care and Cancer Supportive Care in Scarborough. And Caitlin Shetterly, a breast cancer survivor, and her new novel, she's a writer, is out tomorrow. It's called Gulf of Lions. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to get tips to live frugally in the face of rising prices. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.